Welcome to Alert and Oriented's new mini-series, The Doctor's Playbook, where we dive into the minds of medical experts to explore clinical reasoning, diagnostic strategies, and the art of patient care. In each episode, we'll unpack the frameworks, insights, and lessons that have shaped their journeys as clinicians. Our goal is to help you refine your approach by merging their expertise with your own unique style, empowering you to navigate complex cases and deliver exceptional care. Along the way, we'll also explore their personal stories, career paths, and the values that drive their practice. Whether you're a medical student, resident, or a seasoned physician, there's something here for everyone. My name is Andrew Mohama, and I'm excited to be your host for today's episode.
This excellent medical student-led podcast is for educational purposes only and not intended to be used as medical advice under any circumstance.
Hello, everybody. Today, I'm pleased to be sitting across the table from Dr. Richard Abrams. Dr. Abrams is a distinguished internist based in Chicago, Illinois, with a longstanding affiliation with Rush University Medical Center. He earned his medical degree from University of Illinois College of Medicine in 1986, and then completed his residency in internal medicine at Rush University Medical Center, where he also served as chief resident and then continued into attending practice ever since. At Rush, Dr. Abrams holds a position of professor of medicine and serves as the associate dean of learning environments. Dr. Abrams has been instrumental in the internal medicine residency program at Rush, previously serving as program director. His leadership has been influential in mentoring numerous medical professionals, contributing significantly to their development and the advancement of the program. In clinical practice, Dr. Abrams specializes in general internal medicine. His expertise encompasses both primary care and hospital medicine, reflecting his commitment to patient-centered care across various settings. Throughout his career, Dr. Abrams has been dedicated to medical education, mentorship, and patient care. His contributions have left a lasting impact on the medical community at Rush and beyond, influencing both current practices and future directions in internal medicine. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Abrams.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is very exciting because for some of you who have listened to the podcast before, Dr. Abrams has been with the podcast since its origins with Kevin Grudzinski, where it has been primarily a clinical reasoning podcast. And we thought to add this Doctor's Playbook series where we can actually get a little bit of taste of what goes on behind the scenes of how Dr. Abrams thinks, how residents think, and all in all to make us better thinkers in clinical medicine. So before we move on, Dr. Abrams, is there anything else you'd like to introduce about yourself before we get into some conversation?
I guess the only thing I say is sort of as you say, as you said, I've been here for a long time. And so next academic year will be my 40th year here. And what that means actually is I'm closer to the end than the beginning. So I do have to say that. But the thing I do want to say, and I think it's really important for people to hear, and that is the choice to go into, and I'm talking broadly about medicine, not just internal medicine, but the choice to go into medicine, certainly for me, was a great choice. And now at this phase of my career, if somebody said, would you do it again? The answer is I'd do it in a second. Medicine is the best career that you can have. And so, you know, we sit in a world now where people sometimes complain about whether it's medicine in general or being a doctor. And again, the reality is that it is such a good gig.
That's really exciting to hear, especially, you know, for me, I'm finishing up my third year of medical school, and it's easy to see a lot of varying opinions on this, but someone like you who's been working in the field for such a long time and have such a good perspective on it. And I can attest to Dr. Abrams loving his job. I was on the general internal medicine floors the past 2 months, and every time I'd walk by, he'd be smiling, he'd be talking to someone, and really just excited to be there, still doing patient care after all these years. So thanks, Dr. Abrams, for keeping that excitement. And I think in line with that is where I'd like to start, which might be somewhere a little interesting, and it's bringing you back to a remark you made in the past. So in researching a little bit about you and prep for this conversation, I listened to an interview you did in 2020, and you gave a very reflective insight on joy. You said, "The joy in medicine exists in three parts: the joy in what you do, the joy in working with others, and finding joy within yourself. We should ask ourselves how we can start to find joy in each compartment of our life. Now, I want to ask you, 5 years later, and this far into your career, how does joy play a role in your life? And what does this mean to you today?
So, you know, I use that quote or that saying when I was involved in recruiting residents at that time. And so as you go do this, and I've done this for now 30 years, as we're doing it now, you're always looking for something new to say. And that saying for me always came out of a way I feel. And so this concept of joy, which I talked about then, and it's a concept I still think about now, was something I actually got out of, I don't know, Andrew, do you ever read that book? And I think it was written by the Dalai Lama, right? And I wish I had walked in with it. And it is about finding joy. And it is almost like I say, so, you know, we talked about a second ago how much I love being a doctor. So again, doing the clinical reasoning, taking care of patients, it brings me joy, and that's attached to my professional career. Okay, so that's one piece of it. I brought a prop, and the prop that I brought, because even though nobody can see it, is something that I keep close to me. And this prop is actually in it has the pictures of my co-interns. Okay, and so if you go back to 1980s, and then I would pull this book out, you'd see a couple things. So one thing you would see if you looked at my intern class is that for lack of better terms, we all kind of looked alike. So if you were to start reading the names and the faces, of course, I'm an AB, so I'm always in the top left corner. But as you go across the names and the faces, I can, without even looking, I can tell you the names. So, you know, next to me would be sitting a Mark, and next to Mark would be sitting Frank, and then there'd be Joe, and then there'd be Mike. And you guys can kind of get the picture. You know, if we were really lucky, we had like a Caroline in there. And so that was the face of medicine in 1986. And for lack of better terms, you could say it was a bunch of white guys. And I'll say this also, and that is, I really liked it. So that's, you know, that's what I came into. And that's what it was. But now 40 years have gone by. And if you were to look at the same faces, you would see that they're very different. So people often ask me, what are the real miraculous changes in medicine over the time I've done this? And my answer to that is actually not, you know, discovered X or we've discovered Y, but the biggest and the best change has been the changing of those faces. Okay. And that gets back to the people that you're with. And so the faces look different, but the faces look more like the faces of the world that we live in. And so the people you work with are really, really important. Okay, so they are really important, and you do want them. And the last thing you want is a group of people that are all like you. You want a group of people that are all different. The other piece of it, and this gets to the doctor piece of it, going back to the joy in what you do, and that is the faces look more like the patients that we take care of. And what that means is it means that there's better patient care now. Again, it's no knock on what we did before. It's no knock on anything. The whole point of it is that things are always supposed to get better. So that is one piece of it. The other piece of it is this. So the corollary to that, also sort of, I step back and I say, God, when I was an intern, when I was a resident, it was an individual sport. That was what, you know, God, I could think of nights I was on a floor by myself with 40 patients, literally by myself. And it wasn't good. It wasn't good for me. It wasn't good for the patients. And now medicine has become a team sport. And so think of it. This big, broad group of people and working together as that group. So there's the joy piece in that. And then the last piece, as I said, it is the joy, and it's the joy that you find personally. And again, I could say I love this job, but you know, everybody still has to go home at some point. And so what do you do? What are the things that you do when you're not here that fill you up or that fulfill you? And those are so personal. Okay. I mean, that's because I could say I like to go out and ride my bike. Somebody else might want to do something else. And so you need to find those things because it's all three of these pieces that sustain us.
Thanks, Dr. Abrams. I think that's a really reflective insight. And what I'm hearing is how important community is in medicine. You know, from the beginning of your intern year, you still remember those names. And now over the many years, I'm sure you've added such a long list of names of people that are probably like family to you. And that's what's so exciting about this progression you've mentioned, which is the continued diversification of who joins medicine, looking more like our patient populations, is that we are not separate selves. When we go into patient rooms, we are connected with the patients, with our colleagues, with the hospital, with that local community. And it seems to me that you've garnished a lot of joy from just noticing that community expand and, you know, including as many people as possible. So it's really great to hear that you've been able to remain grounded and reflective over all these years. I'd like to go into some questions about clinical reasoning insights. And this is an interesting question for someone like you who's been in practice for a long time. And I'm curious, you know, over the years, you've probably seen a lot of pathology. You've seen a lot of different patient cases. So I'm assuming you have a mental database of all these patterns, you know, based on what you've seen. And what I'm curious is, how do you balance pattern recognition with deliberate methodical reasoning so that you avoid jumping into a premature conclusion about a diagnosis, about management, or just about a patient in general?
Okay, so everything you talk about is, we talked about connection, so we're going to talk about connection again. And it is sort of like you say, you know, people, if you read the literature about this, there's certain topics or phrases that turn up again and again. So for example, you already said there are illness scripts that we talk about, and in some ways illness scripts are really important. Okay. And I might say this because I think this way. So I am much more of a lumper than I am a splitter. And when I think of, I almost think about symptom scripts as opposed to illness scripts in many ways, okay? And because it doesn't get me stuck in a very specific diagnosis, it leads me into a pattern. And then once I get into that pattern, like what are the things that cause shortness of breath, then I can go down my little path. So I'd say for me, that's always been important. The other thing that I do have to say, and if you look at literature on what I would call deliberate practice, and there is a lot, you know, that's the, you know, if you read any Malcolm Gladwell who really sort of, you know, sort of dumbed it down and popularized it, it's sort of the 10,000 hour rule. And to me, what that means is, there's no substitute for doing. So reading never, ever, ever substituted for doing. And this, that does not mean you don't read. It just means that reading without the context of a patient, for me, you know, I did it to pass the test, but I don't think that that's how I really learned about whether it's diagnostic reasoning or else patient care broad. So I think about things a little bit that way. And you're right. I mean, I do. I mean, I've had the fortune of doing this for a long time, and And experience really does. Experience counts so much in this. I mean, we can talk about AI later, and there's no question that AI will be a part of everything that we do in the future. But I'm not sure that there are certain things, at least now, that AI can't do, because there are certain subtleties that are there. And we can go into those if you want.
Right. And there's a creativity that you develop. There is a craft and an art form that comes with practice in really any career or hobby, you know. So I think that's one of the things to think about. You know, you mentioned this also in that interview 5 years back where you talked about the art of medicine and how really that's what it comes down to. We all read the same things. We all, you know, more or less get taught the same things, and we can all think about it. But the doing, right, that gap between thinking and doing, which you talked about, closing that is really an artistic form. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, so the answer is yes, it is. But I want to jump back a little bit and in some ways even tail back to what we talked about before. And that is that sometimes clinical reasoning is a team sport, okay? And so much of what I've learned about this topic has come from by talking about, whether it's cases or lots of other things, with other people. I mean, you know, my great fortune, and if I'm even somewhat good at this, is that I essentially sat next to my mentor for 20 years. And if I ever had a case I didn't understand, he was the first person I went to talk about it. And listening to him reason out a case was a very, very powerful thing for me. And again, there's lots of ways, in my mind, there's lots of ways to do this. And you have to find your way. And just like everything else, I say this, you want to hear a lot of people do this. And then you pick out the way, number one, that you can do the best, because you should always play to your strengths. And then you're looking for those little things that you can add on. And you learn those things by listening or by watching other people do this process.
Yeah, I think that's really insightful. And it reminds me of actually what Kevin Grudzinski, founder of Alert and Oriented, and now third year resident of medicine at Northwestern, he said in our conversation, he said, don't reason in isolation. He said, if I could put one thing on a billboard to, you know, blast out to all learners, it's that phrase, don't reason in isolation. And it's true that that is how you develop your craft, by picking up of what you like from others. And I do think there is a component of vulnerability that goes with that. I think in medicine, we're trained to be confident and you know, not show weaknesses in some ways. But I think it takes skill and courage to go into a workroom, go to a mentor, go to someone who has experience and say, I don't know how to think through this, or I think I'm stuck. And, you know, as a medical student, I'm stuck a lot, right? I'm very early in my learning. So I'm curious for you, you know, towards the end of your career, do you still find that you have to build up courage and vulnerability to share maybe where you don't know something or where you're stuck? Or is it second nature to you because of how much you value teamwork?
I think it's here. I'll say this. I always walk into all these things saying, I don't know anything. So I start from that point. You know, you mentioned Kevin. So Kevin was he was a third year student when we met. And I'm going to tell you, I ask students all the time to what they think, because often they may know things that I don't know. And so to me, the default is I can have my, you know, this, I can have my opinions, but they are just opinions. And those opinions are either, you know, they're either confirmed or they're disputed by discussions with other people. And certainly I say to every one of my medical students, and certainly every one of my residents, and that is, if you think that I'm doing the wrong thing, you have got to stand up and you have to stop me. Because chances are I'm doing the wrong thing. Okay. And now I might say, here's why I'm doing X, or here's why I think X. And And that's fine. So there's no, I mean, I got no ego. I got no ego necessarily at stake with being right. I mean, going back to what excites you about medicine, what excites me about medicine in some ways is getting to an answer. I'm not as excited by, I figured out the answer. I'm excited by we figured out the answer. And remember, sometimes, you know, your biggest partner in all this stuff is your patient, right? So unless they're included in this process, you know, you're really, really likely to get led astray. And certainly when it comes to the treatment pieces, now we're talking about clinical reasoning, but eventually the reasoning is used in order to come up with some sort of treatment plan. If you don't involve the patient, I think you're probably almost always going to get to the answer.
Yeah, I completely agree. Just from the little I've experienced so far. And I think it goes to say that it's impressive. You've maintained this ability to level set and share, I don't know, I might be wrong. Stop me when I'm wrong. And I think that speaks to the culture that you're able to bring to your medical teams. It's what got me excited about pursuing medicine in some ways, being the physician, is that you can kind of create the environment in which you practice. And if you come into that workroom, you come into that team with a willingness to be wrong, a willingness to take medical student opinions or resident opinions over your own as a well-versed physician, I think it inspires folks to give their best, not to, you know, shy away. And I think it inspires them to work together. And, you know, there is a hierarchy in medicine, but in some ways it eliminates the more surface level components of that.
So I'm a recovering program director. So that means I used to be a program director. And so one of the only things that you really have to do as a program director when a resident completes a program. So we're talking about internal medicine now, so I'll say that. So at the end of your residency, program director's job is to certify that you or the resident is capable of the independent practice of internal medicine, in this case, without supervision. Okay? So unless I trust your decisions, unless I give you the chance to make those decisions, how can I possibly say that you can do it independently? And so listen, unless you ask for those things, now you're saying whether it's a student or a resident, they can never, never, never develop. And here's the other reality, and that is my own expectation as an educator, or as a person, for God's sakes, my own expectation is that the students and residents I work with will be better than me when they're done. Because if I've done a good job, then they will, right? That is, I mean, listen, everybody's parent wants their kid to be better than them, right? So it's the same thing here. And for God's sakes, I got a high stake in it because you guys are going to be taking care of me sooner rather than later. So those are really big deals. I can't conceive of any place where what the learners thought wouldn't be important, okay? That doesn't mean they don't have to be right, okay? You don't. Actually, one of the things you got to learn is that you're not always going to be right, okay? And so that's why you're asking everybody else, because if it's all you made it impossible for yourself. You made it impossible for yourself, and it's not good.
Agreed. Yeah, and I think it's really good for medical students and early residents to hear that because, you know, I'll speak for myself. It doesn't feel good to mess up or to get something wrong or to be completely off the right track. But oftentimes, in retrospect, it turns out to be a really helpful experience. And in light of that, I'd like to ask this question for you, because you have so many experiences, is if you could share a, you know, quote, favorite failure in your medical journey, something that maybe felt like a setback right away, but ultimately shaped you into a better clinician.
Oh, my God, I've made so many mistakes. You know, we could talk about my first night as an intern, for God's sakes, and I still can, you know, it's one of those things. I don't know if anybody, you remember it, but I mean, I can remember all the things that I did wrong. I tell people the story. So my first night of internship, I actually had two things happen that, of course, I'll never forget. And maybe it is because it's the first night. So one of the things that I remember is I actually had to put a central line in on someone. And of course, maybe I did one in medical school, but the bottom line is this, and that is I put the central line into somebody's carotid artery. Okay. And I remember, and I was horrified beyond belief. I remember my resident coming by and saying, you know, you're going to have to stand here for like, you know, an hour and put pressure on this thing so it doesn't happen. And you know, something like that happens. And of course, it makes you afraid to do the next one. It also gives you some idea of the responsibility that you have, right? So you never want to hurt someone. But it's things like that that reinforce the responsibility you have. And, you know, that's a big thing. But, you know, for God's sakes, giving somebody IV fluids or any medicine, there's a certain amount of responsibility you're taking. The other thing that happened to me my first night, and this is another story I tell. I remember I'm on call, and it's about 6 o'clock, and I get this call asking me to come up and that I need to put some sutures in the patient because they suffered a. So I go up to the room, and there's glass all over the place because the patient had climbed up, actually tried to break the window and get out of. And I remember, of course, being terrified. So that's the first thing you remember. But I remember, you know, looking at this woman, now she's back in bed and I'm doing this. And what ultimately bothered me the most about it was that I didn't say a word to her. Okay. So she was quiet and I did what I had to do. But at some level, I didn't do what I had to do, right? Which is to talk to her, for God's sakes, and ask her, you know, what happened? Why did this happen? And of course, because this happened, this was on a medicine floor, you know, 2 hours later, she magically disappeared and was, you know, taken to a different part of the hospital. And I just remember sitting there and saying, why didn't I say something?
Yeah, thanks for sharing. It's well, and it's clear to me that all these years later, you remember with such detail, such memory. And I think maybe on the other side of reflection of stories in your career, you know, I'm curious what you took from that encounter, which was talking, listening, maybe perhaps into other patient encounters. And I might put you on the spot to share the story you've shared with me before, because it's so profound and impactful. But the story of the patient that you helped get married. In their room. I think people would probably love to hear the story if you don't mind sharing as a memorable encounter.
Okay, I'll give you that in a second, but there's one thing I do have to say, and that is you remember the mistakes you made more than the good things you did. Okay. And right. I can give you, you know, 50 things that I still think about. And so those never go. So the flip side or a different story, and I could bring the prop. I'll show you after we record. So I had this very dear patient that I took care of for many years, and he was a retired, I think he was a school admin, he was either a teacher or an administrator, and I had him became my patient very early when I was an attending. And the thing about him, which was I always laugh about, was that he was almost deaf. For God's sakes, he was, you know, he'd come in with these various sort of amplifier devices, and every couple months he'd have a new one. And basically most of the, you know, the you know, our visits were sort of me really sort of yell. We would yell back and forth at each other. And maybe a couple years after I first met him, he actually, we were, one of the nice things about primary care is that, you know, after a while you've talked about everybody's medical problems, so you get to know people. And so we got to, one time he came in and he was telling me, his wife had died a number of years before, but he was telling me about his girlfriend. So he came in very excited because he had this girlfriend. And it actually turned out that, whether it was right at the beginning or shortly after they met, that she had breast cancer, and that a lot of what he did with her was to help take care of her and to help her get through the treatment. And time goes on, and one time he comes in and he says, you know, the two of us are getting married. You know, as he said, you know, proposed to her, something like that, that they were going to get married. And then, you know, shortly after that, actually she came to one of the visits and I had a chance to meet her. And right around this time, he actually got sick himself. And over the space of a relatively short time, he went from having been a caregiver to being a care receiver. And so she started caring for him. And because he was very sick, he would end up in the hospital a number of times. And she was totally and completely fierce. So she would sit by his bed the entire time. And if you walked in there and, you know, if you wanted to listen to his lungs, she would, you know, she would be, well, why, things like that. And so actually she scared off all the interns and residents who took care of him. She scared the nurses a little bit. But eventually, you know, we got to the point where it was clear that he was going to pass away. And he and I had this, you know, like I said, he said, I'm going to marry this woman. And for whatever, they had never gotten married. So near the end, I remember we were sitting together and he was in some ways even going in and out of consciousness sometimes at that time. And we said, well, why don't you, this is it. If you're ever going to get married, this is it. And so we managed, I remember talking to the chaplain and obviously she said yes. And so we actually held a wedding ceremony inside his room very, very, very shortly before he died. And it was, you know, listen, it was an honor and it was a wonderful thing. So
thanks for sharing that. What a memorable experience. And, you know, I think like there's something about the way you carry yourself in patient rooms, Dr. Abrams, that extends a hand of humanity. I should say, from just what I'm hearing, what I'm observing. And it makes me think a lot about how does being human, you know, willing to connect on these levels, make you a better clinician? And I know it does. We both know it does. But I'm curious if you could put words to this, because there is a gap between, you know, say, master diagnostician, really good scientist, good thinker, but good human, good connector. And what do you see there to be a connection?
So opinion, and this is something that I did learn from my mentor. So my mentor was my program director. And many people considered him to be, and this is true because, and not making this story up, he was considered to be one of the best diagnosticians in the country. I mean, literally, he made an international name for himself. He never published a paper. He published one paper ever, but he was an infectious disease doctor, and he was just nationally known. And he was really smart, but he wasn't, that was only part of what made him. And other part that made him better was he was great with people. I mean, he was, if you had a chance to watch him, and I remember because I had a long chance to watch him, what was incredible was how he connected with people. And so, at least to me, you can't be one without the other. Okay, so you might diagnose the illness, but you won't diagnose the illness in that person. Okay, and they're different, right? So one, you know, you can pick up a pathology book and you can read about, you know, whatever it is, but you can never understand how it affects that person without understanding that person. And I don't think that you can, and now we get back to the treatment because, you know, I don't know how important, I'm asking you this question now, so I'm putting you on the spot. How important is diagnosis without doing something about it, or at least thinking about what you can do?
It's really not that important.
So you're right. It really isn't that important.
Yeah.
And so you got to make, so that connection is the important piece. And that connection, it's a human connection. And so how can you exclude the other piece of it? Now, I can understand if you're just doing a procedure or something like that, but even probably then you might do the wrong thing if you didn't think about it in the context of a person. So I just find these, I find them to be really, they're connected in a way that is hard to separate. Now, that goes back to the AI thing I talked about before, and that is will computers, whatever, ever be good enough to understand that piece? Or the other piece is how do you enter that information in to do it? And so I don't have an answer, but it's, you know, kind of, it is the way sort of what I think it is. The other piece is, and maybe this will be the last thing I say about this subject. So, and this is my feeling about internal medicine. So in internal medicine, we actually don't cure very many people. I mean, have I ever cured anybody who has diabetes? No, maybe, I don't know, maybe very unique cases. You know, do we cure hypertension? So we don't cure people. And, you know, you could say, well, I would never go into internal medicine. You don't cure anyone. But to me, and this goes down to what's the core job of a doctor? Core job of a doctor is to take care of people, okay? Nice when we cure them. It's nice when we can cure them, but we can always take care of them, right? And that gets back to the humanity piece. The humanity piece is we're caring for a person. And again, that's a big part of the joy of being a doctor is that connection.
Well, thank you. I resonate a lot with this, and I hope people who listen do as well. And if they haven't thought about it that way, I hope they carry that reflection with them. And I think the only other thing I'd like to ask on this, maybe a tactic or skill or strategy, if you may, how do you, with such a busy schedule, busy patient list, you know, think it's a, you know, you got around, you got all these things you got to take care of. How do you pause, or what do you do? Is there some sort of tactic you employ to ensure that you don't miss the humanity, that you don't miss the presence required to factor in the humanity of what you're doing in what you're doing? You know, what would you recommend to people, or and that has worked for you?
In many ways, I'm at a good phase of my life now where, you know, listen, when I'm on inpatient service, I've got interns and I've got residents around and they're students. And so there's certain things I don't have to do anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I can focus on sort of the bigger things. But listen, I spend a lot of time in the office seeing patients and you know, everything's scheduled out there also. And I don't know if I have the perfect answer to this because all these things connect, you know. There's, as we talked at the beginning, you need to make space for yourself also. So I don't think anyone either could or should work all the time. okay? Even if it's something you love and people say, well, it's not work, and maybe it's not, but you still need some space, to, whether it's to clear your head or something like that. And so you need those times. And in my mind, what it means is you need to prioritize those times. You need to decide, number one, you know, what are those things that bring you joy that aren't this? Okay. You have to have those things. And then you have to be somewhat flexible with that time. I think maybe to answer your question, and that is you can, listen, the times don't need to be often as much as you think. The other thing is that you can incorporate, there's a lot of room for twofers in this. Okay. There really are a tremendous amount. You know, when you're examining someone, you can talk to them about things. You can connect with them in a certain way. Sometimes, listen, for God's sake, sometimes little touches are, you know, become those things that sustain you. But so again, I haven't given you a clear answer for this. It's just that I'm not sure. We get hung up in details a lot, and I understand certainly if you're an intern or something like that, you're anyways, that's your job is to do the details. But I'd say certainly for students that you should have time to do all these. You should have time to do all these other things. You're making me think of one piece of advice that I just have to say to every medical student out there. And that is that whenever you see a patient, for lack of better terms, I say, go in with a clean slate. And that is, there's so much pressure for you to sort of, you know, read up on the person before you go in, or you know, if you're on an inpatient service, you know, what does the ER say? What, look at all the tests. And actually, I actually think that that's not, I don't think that that's actually time well spent. It's time spent better afterwards, and you'll be more efficient at it afterwards. And so you need, and I do this now also, I mean, I've done this forever, and that is, I do not bias myself with what other people think. I mean, I will almost always go in to see a patient often without reading an ER note or something like that. I don't want to know what other people think until after I've had a chance to think for myself. So, and in many ways that helps with what you say. Maybe I'm dating myself a little bit. I don't like to get bogged down in people's records. And that's not to say there's not a time and a place for that, because you don't want to punish people by repeating things again and again and again. But I don't think you're ever punishing someone if you go in and without all the biases that come in. And there's a large group of patients that I think that those biases that we have doing that lead us to the place.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, that's all incredible advice. And I think just to say it back, what I'm hearing in multiple parts here is, first, make time for yourself to make time for others. You need that time for yourself to be able to have the capacity to care. And two is, little gestures go a long way. It doesn't take a massive effort to connect with someone. And maybe lastly is to think about approaching a patient as a clean slate, not thinking about what their past was, maybe what brought them down personally or medically, and giving yourself that fresh perspective and then maybe reviewing it after. Well, Dr. Abrams, this has been an inspirational and incredible conversation, and just want to thank you for joining us in this capacity and for all of your mentorship, your advice, the culture you've helped create at Rush. It's not only impacted me, but I know it's impacted plenty of people. So thank you very much. And just want to leave it to you. Is there anything at the end you'd like to say?
No, I want to thank you for having me. I do want to say one of the great things about working in a place like this, I know there's lots of good places though, is first of all, obviously, is the patients, but our opportunity to work with learners get way, way more out of it than you guys think. I mean, I'd argue we get way more out of it than we probably do to you. So thank you, and I, you know, listen, I, as you've said, I've had the opportunity to work with a lot of medical students and residents over the years. And no question, it's made me a better doctor and it's made me a better person also. So thanks again.
Amazing.
Thanks again for listening. Person, time, and place. We'll see you next time.